Welcome to Rip from the Headlines, Week 16. Just to begin, I wanted to dedicate this year in memory of my grandfather, Yoel Diana, who just passed away on Motzei Shabbos, Yoel Emanuel Ben David, Zichrono Livracha. The first article that I wanted to talk about is Wyoming District will open one student school next fall, from the Associated Press, February 23, 2019. Laramie, Wyoming. A Wyoming school district plans to reopen an isolated school to serve a single student entering kindergarten this fall. The Laramie Boomerang reports, Cozy Hollow School is about 60 miles north of Laramie. A modular classroom is already there, but hasn't been used for about a decade. It will be the second one-student school in the Albany County School District. They're only a few miles apart, but connecting roads are impassable much of the winter. Wyoming law requires on-site education for isolated students when it's impossible to transport them to other schools. The district tried live-streaming classes for isolated students, but it didn't work well, especially for young children. District officials say it'll cost about $150,000 combined to educate the two students next school year, and that's where the information is from.
Surprises aren't more than that, actually.
Yeah, that is quite cheap. I mean, it's basically, you know, hiring someone full-time. I mean, I guess there's not much upkeep for the buildings there.
I guess, because that sounds like... That sounds like only salary, really.
Yeah.
For two teachers.
So, anyways. That's what happens. Okay. Yeah, maybe. I was going to say, I'll take that as a tax break instead, if you want. It's for homeschool my kid. Okay. So, I mean, I thought this was a very interesting article. The reason why I chose it, though, was actually very interesting. Sitting at the Shiva this week, someone said, you know, there's a joke that goes around Ottawa, which is where my grandfather lived and where my father grew up, which is that there was always a Deanna in the first graduating class of every Jewish school. Because whenever it came time for one of the kids to go to a particular school, or whatever stage and whatever age it was, my grandfather worked hard and, you know, tried to build up the infrastructure in the school so his kids would be able to go there. So that was the joke. Hence, every first graduating class had a Deanna in it. But he was very, very involved in the Jewish community in Ottawa altogether. And I remember, like, seeing my father, three kids in a class, two kids in a class. But no, it was still so important to him that not only, you know, people have a Jewish upbringing somewhat, but even particularly an Orthodox upbringing. There are plenty of stories here. I can tell you, he actually, luckily for us, wrote up an autobiography. For the last few years, he spent working on it for a very, very long time. So we have, hundreds of pages on his life and his stories, and including, you know, little tidbits about how, you know, for example, the Maimonides School, which he wanted to establish. So I'll read you a little section from here, and you can just sort of see what type of person he was in terms of how he'd push through for stuff like this. You know, you think, like, what is it, 5 kids, 10 kids, you know, that were there that he felt they could do a little bit better for. And there was another school, you know, known as Hillel Academy, which, you know, didn't provide the best religious education for students, in his opinion. So he said, as mentioned above, the coming of Rabbi so-and-so heralded a new era for the Ottawa Jewish educational milieu, with the arrival of families with, Baruch Hashem, more children, such as Lubavitch, Chafetz Chaim, Yeshiva Rebbeim, and in addition, locals who became more aware of the importance of a better Torah education. The establishment of a religious school became a real necessity. An ad hoc committee of Rabbi so-and-so, and myself decided to found such a school. It would temporarily be located in a West End public school until a permanent location will be purchased. The principal was Madame so-and-so, and the school followed a French immersion program, which also attracted students from non-religious homes who were interested in becoming fully bilingual. The Hebrew teaching staff was made up of learned rabbis and female teachers, e.g. Mrs. so-and-so and my grandmother Rachel Diana, and the secular teachers were all very qualified in their field. As an example of the school professionalism, the mathematics teacher insisted on having tapes of Mozart music as background noise during his lessons.
Well, pretty much ahead of his time, because they say that Mozart is... learning.
At the beginning, Maimonides was very successful in its growth and financial status. We welcomed all the children independently of their religious affiliation, Hasidim, or Midnagdim, or Sephardim, and even the non-religious found a friendly and hospitable environment. Insofar as the monetary aspect of the school, Rabbi so-and-so and myself went around collecting in Ottawa, and even in Montreal and Toronto. Then under the guidance and leadership of so-and-so, we started together with the Chafetz Chaim Yeshiva and the Temple Israel a bingo game partnership. that brought a large amount of funds to the school. So-and-so and myself were part of this bingo business organization, and we worked very hard for many years to be able to finance Maimonides. I must say that unfortunately there was never any positive recognition of this effort. On the contrary, if any time or anything went wrong, so-and-so and I were the only ones held responsible. Okay? And what's interesting to note, this is very funny. Before I proceed with the next topic, I'd like to insert here an interesting note on the Ottawa Jewish School Board, which organized a meeting of schools' representatives to discuss the city's educational situation. The exchange of views is very friendly. However, at one point, the spokesperson for the Reform School looks in my eyes and asks loudly so that the whole audience would hear, "And you, from the Orthodox School, would you hire a Reform rabbi to teach in your school?" "Of course," I answered as the listening public gave a sigh of relief, then it continued. "I would hire the Reform rabbi to teach gymnastics."
See how many ways you could twist yourself, yes.
Anyways, but that was sort of him, you know, always very friendly with everybody, but, you know, not willing to compromise on things that he felt were very important, but he continues, and you just see sort of the work they put in. Returning to my main topic, my major contribution to Maimonides School growth was the work connected with the purchase of a building in Esquimalt Drive in Nepean. It started with the public announcement of whatever, and he goes through a story of how he worked to fundraise, how he worked to talk here and talk there and make arrangements to have a campus, to have money coming in, and how he worked so hard towards that, that this was sort of something that he did. So I saw this story, it brought a little smile to my face this week. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to talk about the
timing is quite incredible as well.
Yeah, I mean, this was, you know, February 23rd. Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, a few days ago. It was, you know. And interesting, I thought I would talk about something which I heard a story from someone, you know, a little while back. And this was not, you know, related to my grandfather in any way, but certainly very unfortunate, but interesting. Where they said they knew a girl in their community who had some psychological issues, where she honestly believed that the only thing that was happening in the world was happening to her. And nothing else actually existed. So while she wasn't here, I mean, we see what's going on in our perception, and that's it. There really isn't anything else going on. This is what this girl believed, and she was, you know, I guess, seeing someone. And she always used to tell people, you know, you need to say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. The world was created for me. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about that when we talk about a one-student school of, you know, creating a whole world for one student.
Very good.
And, you know, to talk about what Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam means and some lessons we can take from that as well. First of all, I'm not even going to try to pronounce this here, but this first Wikipedia article tells us about some, you know, philosophical belief is the variety of idealism, which asserts that nothing exists externally to this one mind, and since this mind is the whole of reality, then the external world was never anything more than an idea. It can also be expressed by the assertion there is nothing external to these present experiences. In other words, no reality exists beyond whatever is presently being sensed. That seems like a pretty good description of what was going on here. This is an actual, you know, metaphysical idea, I guess. You know, and you can read through it a little bit more. But this does come from what's really a very, very long Mishnah, where we know this phrase, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, the world was created with me. There's a very famous Hasidic story of a Hasidic rabbi, Rav Simcha Bunim of Peshitzcha, I think, where he had in one pocket, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, in the other pocket, Anochi Afar Ve'efer, I'm worthless. And, you know, sometimes you got to take it out of one pocket, sometimes you got to take it out of the other pocket. There's a certain balance. And that balance is, I'm the only one that's important versus I'm nothing. And that's a very interesting look at it. But I figured if we looked back at the context of the Mishnah, we could get a little bit of an idea as to what's going on. And for that, I'll read the English here, which is actually already on page number 2, in source number 2. And it's talking about when witnesses come to testify in a capital case. How do we press the witnesses in a capital case? We bring them into the court's chambers and press them. Perhaps what you say isn't eyewitness testimony, but your own assessment or from rumors, or you're witnessing an actual witness testify, you're reporting what a trustworthy person said, or perhaps you're unaware that by the end we'd interrogate you with examination and inquiry. Know that capital cases are not like monetary ones. In monetary cases, a false witness can return the money and achieve atonement. But in capital cases, the blood of the victim and all future offspring hang upon you until the end of time. For thus we find, in regard to Cain, who killed his brother, the bloods of your brother scream out. The verse does not say blood of your brother, but bloods of your brother, because it was his blood and also the blood of his future offspring screaming out. Okay? Another explanation of the verse, by the way, as an aside, for his blood was splattered over the trees and rocks, there was more than one pool of blood. The judge's speech continues. It was for this reason that man was first created as one person. To teach you that anyone who destroys a life is considered by scripture to have destroyed an entire world. And that anyone who saves a life is as if he saved an entire world. Okay, right? Because if the whole world comes from one single person to begin, why didn't God create 10 people to begin with? Why just one, and then afterwards two, and then afterwards three, four, five, all the way down to, you know, the billions that we have today? It's to teach you that one life can inhabit a whole world. That's all it takes. And also to promote peace among the creations, that no man would say to his friend, my ancestors are greater than yours. And also so that heretics will not say there are many rulers up in heaven. And also to express the grandeur of the Holy One, blessed be he. For a man strikes many coins from the same die, and all the coins are alike. But the King of Kings, Melech Malchei HaMelechim HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be he, strikes every man from the die of the first man, and yet no man is quite like his friend. Therefore, every person must say, for my sake, the world was created. Bishvili Nivra HaOlam. Okay, so this is the context that this comes in. And it's quite hard to understand what is the lesson of Bishvili Nivra HaOlam, and what is it referring to, and what is it even relating to? What would you think, based on what we've just read, what is Bishvili Nivra HaOlam coming to tell us? Why must a person say this? Right? Every person must say this. Why?
Just as an individual, we make a difference.
So as an individual, we make a difference. So we're basically, right, we're trying to scare someone who's testifying in a capital case. We're saying, listen, if you kill this guy, I mean, this guy is, you know, really, really important. On the other hand, I'm not sure if that gives the message correctly. First of all, we've switched it from the other person, meaning if someone destroys a life, it's as if they destroyed the whole world. We've done that. Now we're saying, Bishvili Nivra HaOlam, the world was created for me. What's up with that? First of all, it seems to be moving towards some of the mitos that we don't like. Meaning it sounds very, you know, sort of haughty. And the whole world was created for me. What's up with that? And why might we be saying it like that? So the Adorama has a couple of interesting comments which I feel, you know, are you know, I don't need to feel anything about them, but the Adorama says them, so that should be enough. But he makes a couple of comments here, some channeling other opinions on the matter, some channeling his own opinion. He says, V'yesh mifarshim. Some explain, L'fikach kol echad ve'echad chayad lomar bishvili nivra olam. By the way, when the Rambam cites this, I should note, the Rambam says, you can say bishvili nivra olam. It doesn't say everybody has to say chayav lomar. But anyway, he says, kol echad ve'echad chayav lomar bishvili nivra olam. In source number 3, De'atama kamakai. Tiktani lefikach nivra adam yechidi ba'olam lelamet shekol ha'me'abed nefesh achad miYisrael kilu yibed olam malei v'tani ala lefikach kevan shemeyadam achad nityashev olam kol echad ve'echad chayav lamar shuli nivra ha'olam. What Yad Rama says is exactly what you were suggesting. He says this goes way back to what it said that man was created, Adam was created just as one, as an individual. If he's created as an individual, it means from one person the whole world is created. Therefore a person should say this. But what does that teach us? What does that tell us? And he continues in a different comment. Here he follows on the next part. The next part is talking about how, if I'm making a coin using some type of mold, all the coins are going to come out the same. But yet when God makes man, despite the fact that it's Bitzelem Elokim, each one is very unique. Everyone has their own DNA, everyone has their own fingerprints, and everyone has their own impact that they can make. And therefore, he says, why is it that everybody must say, Chayav Adam, Lomar, Bishvili Nivra HaOlam? He says, very simple. Chayav Lomar Bishvili Nivra HaOlam, Ulehodot Lifnei HaMakom Al Kach. If God created you different, it means you are one of those people who a whole world could have come from. So your Bishvili Nivra HaOlam is thanking God for putting you here. And realizing that you are, have a special set of talents, you are a very special person. It would have been worthy to create the world just for you, and this is a way of thanking God. God, thank you for putting me here. I'm one person who has, you know, this ability to change the world and to do something in the world, and that's something that we thank God for. But he's another one.
I mean, is it more than just thanks, though? Is it like you can't slack off?
Because we're going to talk about that. That, I believe, is a central message here. The Yesh Amrim Chayav Lomar Chashuv Ani Ba'olam Velo Etrod Atzmi Min Ha'olam Ba'Avira Achat V'Yimashech Himena. And other people say, and this is, I believe Rashi says this, he says, I'm important to the world, I won't, you know, get caught up and remove myself just by doing one avera, meaning it also implies a certain responsibility here. that, you know, and at this point, we're telling it to the witness. Why? To remind him, don't mess up your world. This is no longer, says the Yad Ramah in this answer, as referring to the person, as referring to the person that they're testifying about. It's talking about you. Don't mess up your own world. Bishvili nivra ha'olam. If you witness, you Mr. Witness, are coming in and you want to testify about someone falsely, you better be careful. It's not about him. Never mind him. Kol ha'me'abed nefesh achaz mi'Yisrael kilu ibed olam alei. That's one terrible thing, but this is another thing. Not only are you throwing away his world if you end up convicting him falsely and killing him off, but you're ruining your world as well. And that's another point that he has to say. And again, to realize that God gave you this and be careful of the way that other people's worlds are going. Thus, these are all messages that are trying to come across when someone comes to testify in a capital case. And it's funny, when I was looking for a source on this, I actually bumped into something from Rabbi Kelman, who I actually saw at the Shiva this morning. How ironic. But he says, so important is our own unique individuality. The Mishnah continues that each and every one must say, the world was created for me. It is hard to imagine a more powerful, inspiring, and uplifting teaching than the fact that God created the world for me. Jay Kelman, he created the world for you too, but that's for you to say. The more one feels empowered, the more one aspires to accomplish. And there is nothing more empowering than knowing that the world exists because of me. At the same time, since the world was created for me, I'm responsible for the world. As our rabbis teach in Maimonides' quotes in Hilchot Tshuva, we are to see every one of our actions impacting on ourselves, our communities, and the world at large. And this is, again, Rabbi Kelman in his essay is focusing more on being unique and not feeling the need to fit in with everybody else and just be another carbon copy, right? Just because we're all made from the same mold. Correct, another coin that's been printed from the mold. That's exactly what he was focusing on there and saying, you don't need to always follow along like everybody else in the same, right? You say, you know, so-and-so. The people that come up from this yeshiva are all the same. Right. That's not a great thing either. You know, there has to be a certain individuality to people. And that's what his focus is. Mm-hmm. But it does show you that there's something that we have a responsibility for. When the world is created just for you, you have a responsibility back to the world. Every one of our actions impact ourselves. Every one of our actions impact our communities. And every one of our actions impact the world at large. And this is, again, something very, very important to be saying to witnesses. But also, again, something that I would think back to my grandfather about. And how much he, you know, in a sense, felt this way. And really, you know, his every action were always, you know, positive, valuing other people. And especially this teaching of saving someone's life was something that was very, very important to him. And he watched, you know, as, you know, he was in grave danger during the war. He has unbelievable, unbelievable stories from the war. But the reason why this Mishnah jumped out at me is when I was reading it is from that earlier sentence of Kol HaMakayim Nefesh Achas Mi'Yisrael, because I was in Italy when he went back to honor the righteous Gentiles who saved him during the war. And this was on the plaque, of course, presented to them, Kol HaMakayim Nefesh Achas, Kilu Kiyem Olam Alei. And I'm not here to discuss the Bi'Yisrael part, which different people have different versions of it, but many, many reliable versions do not have the word be Yisrael, a Jewish life, but rather just any life. And of course, that's, you know, the same teaching of the Mishnah. The point is, even one life of anybody is so, so, so important. You know, where he saw people do this for him. And he saw, really, you know, people putting their lives at risk, his life being at risk. And really to sort of live like this, not in the haughty, the world was created for me type of way, but in the very modest and I can make a difference, world was created for me, you know, type of way. And as we said earlier, when it comes to establishing schools, when it comes to education, this was also his view, you know, my kids are going to school, we got to make a school for them. Right. I am living in Ottawa, we've got to establish this committee, that committee, this committee, that committee. I mean, just looking again at his autobiography, there's, you know, 5, 6, 7 different things that he established there and he was involved in from when he got to Ottawa and more. I mean, in addition to the shul, where they were very, very involved, both my grandparents, the Vada Ear Board, you know, Ottawa Jewish Bulletin and Review, Hillel Academy, Maimonides School, Cemetery Committee, 3 or 4 or 5 other organizations, Jewish Youth Library, Chafetz Chaim Yeshiva and its high school, various non-Jewish causes as well. It wasn't just limited to Nefesh Achas B'Yisrael. It was limited to Nefesh Achas anywhere. It was a certain Bishvili Nivra Olam, but every single action has to help other people. And it's really a world of chesed. We say Olam Chesed Yibaneh, to build up that world that we have, you know, requires chesed, kindness. There are many, many, many stories that I could share, which certainly, you know, show that. And you know what? Sometimes those stories come back the other way, and people then come back to you and say, you know what, you know, really, you did this kindness for me, that kindness for me. And but you can see really when someone makes an impact on the world. What's lastly interesting is something that I don't usually quote because I'm not familiar with it, is Likutei Maharan in source number 5. Not necessarily always up my alley, but he says something very interesting here that I stumbled upon when looking through sources that discuss Ki kol ha'olam lo nivra ela bishvili. Ki tzarich kol adam lomar, says Rabbi Nachman. Kol ha'olam lo nivra ela bishvili. Nimtza, turns out, kishe ha'olam nivra bishvili, when the world is created for me, as we said, tzarich ani lirot ul'ayin b'chol et b'tikun ha'olam. I always need, I must constantly look and consider ways of making the world better, ul'malot chesron ha'olam, to add in what the world is missing. And again, as we discussed, this was really sort of the legacy that my grandfather, you know, left. But also to pray on its behalf. And something that I witnessed, especially in these last few months when my grandfather was in the hospital, was how dear davening was to him, and how he was really talking to God, and, you know, praying not only, I'm sure, for himself, but for many, many others as well. And it was honestly very inspiring to see someone who, in general, you know, davened fairly quickly. But just, you know, the special things that he had in life were certain tefillos. Like, you'd see him come in and he would ask me, Ezer, you know, Ezer Loni, can you sit down next to me and can you help me say this? Can we say this along together? This part of Psukei Zimra. Psukei Zimra especially was very dear to me. Certain parts, you're just like, I have to thank God for this. Right? You know, this is fantastic. Again, this is someone lying in a hospital bed with, you know, different issues, you know, throughout this whole stretch. But it was just unbelievable to see. And this was, you know, sort of what was meaningful to him. And as we see, Rabbi Nachman connects these ideas of the world being created for me, but again, praying for everybody else, praying for the world, thanking God for the opportunity to be someone who the world was created for. So that was also very meaningful to see. The other teaching, which we know that connects very, very well to this, and should bring a smile to everyone's face, is Chanoch Lanar Al Pi Darko. When we're talking about a one-person school, right, the Pasuk in Mishlei tells us, right, and I'll use the translation that's provided here, train a child in the way that he should go, right? Al Pi Darko, through his path. And this is something that's used a lot. I saw there's a community lecture on this coming up for Misora Montessori.
It already happened. And he spoke beautifully.
Okay, really excellent.
A fellow probably of Italian descent.
Yes, he is of Italian descent. I met a relative of his, used to
British,
be a...
Of more recent times, because he has a very strong British accent. Uh-huh. I think what's it called in England? Gateshead.
From Gateshead.
But he spoke beautifully on this topic.
Yeah, so Chanoch Lanar Al Pi Darko is very often quoted. People talk about it. In general, what do people assume it to mean?
Know what your child is strong at and trying, or
right,
what their aptitude is, and teach them that way.
Absolutely.
They're learning the skills.
Very good. And it's very interesting because the Gemara has this here. The Gemara notes, and we're going to read the English in source number 6, but that's definitely the way it's taken. I saw the Malbim on that verse in Mishlei explains it exactly this way. Know the strengths, know these weaknesses. And we talked about this as well when I was speaking at the Shiva tonight. You know, knowing strengths and weaknesses and having to go outside. The biggest, you know, message someone can deliver in a sense is when they go outside their comfort zone. When it comes to chinuch, when it comes to bringing someone up, we focus on strengths, and we cater to those strengths in the educational system. But what's hardest to do is to go beyond those strengths and work on something that you're not as good at, something that may be harder for you. But I don't want to talk about that right now. I want to talk about a very interesting gemara. I saw a nice chiddush from the Marsha that I wanted to add in here, which was very interesting. Not necessarily related to anything else, but I just saw it and I said, this is a nice thought, let me share it with you. Says the Gemara on Kiddushin. The Gemara notes that this is like a dispute between Tanaim, based on the verse, train a child in the way that he should go. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemya disagreed about the age in which the verse instructs the parent to educate his child. This is already starting to get a little strange, people, right? One said that the verse is referring to the ages from 16 until 22, and one said it is referring to the ages from 18 until 24. The dispute concerning the correct age for marriage and the dispute about educating a child are the same. As while a father still has a large measure of influence over his son, he must both teach him and find him a wife. Okay. I mean, listen, this is what's going on in the Gemara here. It doesn't quite work very well with our standard understanding of what does it mean catering to someone's strengths. Why should that be limited to a certain time frame? And the Maharsha turns it in a way that I think is very, very meaningful on a number of levels. He says, V'nirah l'fareshit, seems appropriate, correct, to explain, Chanoch l'nar al pi derech teva shelo, educate a child according to their natural ability, but not what their strengths are. That's not what he's emphasizing here. He says, Dahainu zmano, mishitzar af chaf ad chaf beiz. From 16 until 22. Yesh mi she'ra'oi lekabel to'ochacha mechilat tetzayin, v'yesh zmano mi'uchar. B'chol ha'shanim mitetzayin al-fchabbe lefi sichlo v'tivo. He says like this. What chanoch l'nar al-pi darko means is not based on strengths. It's based on when someone's ready to take that next step, whatever it is. And he says here, that's why there's an age range given. Because sometimes there's a 16-year-old that's ready to accept rebuke, to hear something they've done wrong, and sometimes it's a 22-year-old. It depends on the person. Whenever it's right for that person, that's when it should be done. But what this does, it changes the focus to one, again, of being able to move above your natural abilities. Being able to take that next step forward. It's tough to accept criticism for something. So for some people, says the Gemara, that might be at age 16, for other people it's at age 22. We realize that depending on the person, there will be different qualities. And there will be different relationships. There will be different things to say. The other opinion of the Gemara says, no. Nobody's ready at 16. 18 to 24 is that same range. But it's a different sort of look at things. And it also made me think, again, back towards my grandfather, you know, the different relationships that he had, both in the traditional Chanoch L'nar al pi darko approach, where everybody had their strengths, and he had his relationships with this one, with that one, whether this one would be the one that called them more often, this one would be the one that did this, and he, you know, favored them in the same way. This one would be favored in this way, this one would be favored in that way. Everybody had a very special relationship with him amongst his grandchildren, and speaking as the oldest grandchild, we didn't have a funeral here at all, but I did get to collect, you know, a couple of ideas beforehand in case there was. And that's really the way everybody felt. There was sort of this, you know, everybody had their own different but special relationship with Nono. And also, you know, to realize that there, you know, there are different times. If you're not ready, you're not ready. And that's okay. There was no need to be ready. You know, one of Nono's favorite lines was, so if you flunky, you flunky. If I'd come in, I'd be like, oh, listen, I took this exam. I don't really know what's going on. It's okay. You'll get it next time. There's no rush to do it right away at age 16. You can wait till age 22. It's okay. There's no rush, there's no pressure, whenever it's good for you. That's, you know, that is the true Al Pi Darko that the Maharsha is talking about, and that's really something that I felt he exemplified as well as my grandfather and, you know, really my teacher in so many ways. But these were sort of two things that this story made me think about, both that are applicable to the news story that we have, so we can fit it in under that, but also as a chance to sort of share some things from my grandfather. Something else that I wanted to discuss today was just this last little, we'll have 10 minutes here, or maybe even less, on this next news story, which is also related. I mean, let's take a read for it first, which is just an incredibly kind act. Mom on 10-hour flight hands out 200 bags of candy and earplugs in case baby cries. I kid you not, that was today. I finished putting this worksheet together today. I found this article today. Fantastic. A mother on a flight from Seoul to San Francisco was reportedly so worried that her 4-month-old child would disrupt other passengers, she handed out peace offerings in advance of any inconvenience. The unidentified mom gave away more than 200 small bags containing Korean candy, earplugs, and a note apologizing ahead of time for any crying on the 10-hour flight, according to passenger Dave Corona, who posted pictures on Facebook. Today I'm going to the U.S. with my mom and grandma to see my aunt, the note read. I'm a little bit nervous and scary because it's my first flight, which means that I may cry or make too much noise. I will try to go quietly, though I can't make any promises. Please excuse me. Corona described the gesture as very touching, adding, as you know, when you have kids, expect the unexpected. He did note, however, despite the advance warning, that there was not a peep out of the kid, and that's very wonderful. This is just a nice feel-good story, and also kind of cute. You know, you get a little chuckle out of it. At first, it's kind of reminded me of one of the things my grandfather was involved in as a very young child was post-war handing out a lot of food to refugees that were passing through Italy after the war. And, you know, making sure that, and I'm trying to find the section of the biography here. Here we are. So, yes. And he talks about it after the war. He returned home. And he talks about something called Via Unione, which was the street that they had something on. And it was a community, a Jewish community center. And it was at this location that tired, hungry, transient people found a welcoming residence where to rest, eat kosher meals, find old, lost friends, and make new acquaintances. You know, many of them would walk, they'd smoke a cigarette, other people, you know. And one of the main activities of my father was to speak to the authorities and arrange the release of these refugees. On their behalf, he was describing their displaced status, their recent liberation from the terrible death camps, and the promise they would soon leave Italy and emigrate to a welcoming Palestine. And, you know, there used to be police officers who were arresting people that came through for whatever the reason may have been, and my great-grandfather's job was to sort of get them out, but there was all sorts of stuff that my grandfather was involved in, including immediately following the war, handing out stuff, and here's an example. In 1947, the synagogue became the place where many people would come to inquire about joining the Jewish army in Palestine, who was fighting against the array of Arab armed forces. The rule was only Jewish males would have the possibility of filling up an application. One particular case is worth mentioning since I was present when it occurred. You know, a gentleman about 40 years old did not look particularly Jewish, but his family had some resemblance to Jewish root, was actually begging to be sent to Tel Aviv and fight for our survival. And these are the types of things he was involved in. He was involved in helping people. There were emergency, you know, times and all sorts of things. But my father was interviewing him and felt very uncomfortable with his background. He therefore asked this man the following personal question, which basically, loosely translated, says, "Do you have a Brit Milah?" He very seriously replied, "Actually, I left it at home, but I'll make sure to bring it with me next time I come here." Needless to say, this interview did not last for very long, and there was not a next meeting. So, you know, little cute stories like this, but he was very involved in a lot of what was going on there at that time. His father, certainly, but so too he would be involved in things like this and many other things later to help other people out in terms of acts of chesed. Not handing out bags of... I mean, he was a candy man also, but not a candy man on airplanes when he was going with crying kids. You know, there's a lot to take out from stories like this. He did have a tremendous sense of humor, as you can see from these stories. And one of the things is, you know, we talk about, you know, going on airplanes, and we've discussed the smelly couple on the airplane, oh, yes, which actually reminded me of another story that I must tell now that, I mean, if we have an audience here who's heard that story, I'm going to just say one other story about my great-grandfather. Which is just hilarious. What they used to try to get is these meals that were being cooked, they would try to bring them home as well from this sort of central community center for the displaced people and try to bring them home so they wouldn't have to cook. Now the question arises, how could we get these hot meals at home when the distance between the dining room in Via Morosini and the kitchen in Via Unione was significant? The ingenious solution to this problem was devised by my mother, who purchased for my father, who had his office in Via Unione, a very, fancy summer straw bag, which contained three thermoses. These containers, one for the soup, the second for the meat or fish, and the third for the side dishes, were carried from the place to our home at lunchtime by my father every day on the streetcar. Major problems arose when the cauliflower soup or the cabbage salad would emanate unpleasant odors into the closed environment. The crowd standing beside my father on the streetcar would start moving the nostril in search of the guilty smells. Even though this was not an easy task for my father to resolve, he overcame this difficulty by choosing every day one of his most elegant suits and looking disgusted by the foul smell. He would then be among the first passengers to complain loudly about lack of sensitivity of the guilty messenger, to suggest solutions that the courier should start using strong perfumes to cover up these obnoxious odors, that he and the rest of the travelers should begin to wear surgical masks to filter out the fumes. To my great amazement, my father was never accused of being the guilty person. His distinguished looks and fine manners were sufficient to make him a most welcome streetcar traveler every day. But that was a sort of the same sort of sense of humor that he had as well. Again, this was sort of his father about bad smells in closed places. The question is about airplanes, though. From a halakhic perspective, do you have to be concerned about your baby crying on an airplane? With the obvious question being what we know as Gezel Shena, having sleep. So it reminded me of a joke that I've once heard. which was there's a yeshiva bacher who gets on an airplane and he starts watching R-rated movies, and someone sees behind him and says, "I don't understand, but just before you had your hat and jacket on, your gemara, now you get on the airplane, you're watching R-rated movies, how could this be, what's going on?" So he quoted the following pasuk from Devarim, and it's, you know, chapter 30, verse 11, which is in source number 8, the first pasuk, which says that these commandments which I'm commanding you, the Torah is not in heaven. So the Shia Bacher says, the Torah is not in heaven. I don't need to worry about that. That was a cute joke, but you know, obviously this has no halachic relevance in terms of Gezel Shena. And the question is, number one that I'd like to explore in these last few minutes here is, what is the prohibition of Gezel Shena, of stealing sleep, so to say? Is it actually stealing? You know, obviously the question is, can you return sleep? Probably not. You know, maybe sing them a lullaby and they'll fall asleep sooner. I don't really know how that would work. And, you know, would sending out care packages to the rest of the people on the plane, would that help? Can they be mochelit? Things like that. So I figured I would look at a couple of sources here. There's so much wonderful stuff. I'm not going to read through them. Actually, we can. We've got a few minutes left, and especially with Norbert Spitzshear, I think we can go the full 45 minutes.
I'm not sure whether you're going there, that one would expect these kind of distractions and disruptions on a plane flight.
Certainly so.
In other words, yep. It's not like someone is waking someone from their nighttime sleep or having a party next door. Like, I mean, it's, to me, that's not the same type of stealing sleep as when you go on a plane, you can expect that there will be crying babies and you may not get a full night's sleep and other passengers don't have responsibility to keep quiet.
Could be.
I don't know, like, I'm just not sure.
Yeah, could be. It's definitely possible, and that would hinge on something like mechila.
Yeah.
You know, add that you would, you know, there's a certain assumption that you'll be mochel this, but we'll see what some of the ideas are. I'm going to, you know, again, not go too long here, but we'll go a few more minutes. The first source is from a article on davening and minyanim on an airplane. It's fascinating topic, and one that people are sometimes aware of, sometimes not aware of, and oftentimes, you know, sometimes we look at certain situations and we see, you know, oh, there's something nice to do. There's a chumrah, there's maybe a minag, or even sometimes mitzvah derabbanan. And in place of that, you know, we knock over all sorts of yisuri d'oraisa that people might be missing in order to be mekayim that one thing. And that's not always the greatest idea. In terms of a practical lach of minyan on an airplane, sometimes you can do, you know, daven with a minyan, which is certainly a very, very important, you know, halacha. But, you know, it's something that has to be taken, you know, into consideration, along with all of what else is going on in the airplane and what sort of message it might give to other people. One of the things he discusses is Gezel Shena. And he talks about it. Rav Vosner writes in his response to Shevet Halevi that although Gezel is only prohibited when an actual object is taken, there is nevertheless some prohibition of causing another to lose sleep. However, Rav Menashe Klein argues in his Mishnah Lachot that in fact there can be Gezel of a non-tangible object. This position is based off Tosefta and Vava Kamash. There's seven types of thieves, all of whose theft involves some sort of trickery, not stealing a physical object. It's a question of whether or not this can actually be stolen or not. Indeed, Musar sources refer to disturbing one's another's sleep as being a worse form of theft than stealing one's mere possessions. This is because taking away someone's sleep actually affects his body, not just his belongings. Furthermore, it is recounted that the Chavetz Chaim would warn people not to wake others, arguing that disturbing one's sleep is a robbery for which restitution cannot be made. Gezela she'ein la hashava. You can't return it, obviously. It's told about a Yisrael Salander that one morning he criticized one of his students for going out to get water to wash his hands by passing by his neighbor's apartments while they were still sleeping, arguing that netilat yadayim is only a rabbinic decree, whereas stealing someone's sleep is prohibited by the Torah. Regardless of which prohibited category, and this is a later section from the article, Gezel Shena falls into, it is taken very seriously by Poskim and has many ramifications in practical halacha. Should one wake up a sleeping person so that he may pray with a minyan? The basic principle in this regard is that a person may only be awakened if it is to afford him the opportunity to perform a biblical obligation, or if it is known that he would be upset if not awakened. In all other cases, waking him would be prohibited. And, you know, it goes on and on, and, Rav Sternbach even concludes that one should waken someone to pray with a minyan only if one is certain he wants that. Right, again, we're talking about davening with a minion. He says, only if you know the person's going to want to be woken for the minion. But otherwise, you can't wake him up. And, you know, this is, I think, stronger than we saw.
I wonder how that applies to teenagers. Your teenagers.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear. I think it's pretty clear how it applies to teenagers. Yeah. Whatever they feel they want. And, yeah. I mean, certainly your Sternbach's psak. I'm not saying that's psak halacha. You have to ask a rabbi. and your local Orthodox rabbi, but certainly Sternbach's conclusion is pretty straightforward. If the person would want to be woken up, I mean, waking someone up for Kriyat Shema, you know, yeah, you can see actually, and I'd send you to see this article, you know, which is Rabbi Enkin's article in source number 10, which is on the OU website. I don't remember if it actually came from Dalai Lama Shalach, or I actually just put that there. But anyways, to disturb someone who is sleeping or to prevent someone, in source number 10, from falling asleep is a violation of Gezel Shena. In fact, some sources maintain that stealing sleep is even worse than stealing possessions, as we said. This is because one who steals another possessions can usually make restitution by returning the stolen items or reimbursing the owner for their value. On the other hand, lost sleep can never be returned. Stealing someone's sleep is also considered to be a form of personal injury. So you've got personal injury, we've got potentially stealing. How do those look if someone's giving you a gift instead? You know, if they're trying to avoid it also, and it just accidentally happens, we would assume that in these cases, the monetary contributions are something that you could be mochal, I would assume. And you can continue, though. Some authorities hold that stealing someone's sleep violates velo tonu isha tamito, you shall not mistreat your fellow. A biblical prohibition as onat dvarim. And how does that work? While onat dvarim is generally understood to be a prohibition against upsetting or causing pain to others through speech, a number of authorities extend it to include causing others any sort of pain as well. According to this approach, can be suggested disturbing someone's sleep is indeed a Torah prohibition. Similarly, a number of authorities assert that Gezel Shein is a violation of Yahavta L'Recha Kamocha, as no doubt you would not want to be woken up either. So these are some considerations to think about here. In this case, I would assume most people wouldn't consider it bothersome when a baby cried. If you see that, you know, the mother is making so much effort, the baby obviously can't really control itself. But just a certain consideration that there is that you see there that you didn't see with a lot of people. And I thank you for listening to tonight's shiur.
Well, thank you for
and hope that this is not only exactly a little bit of Talmud Torah, but also a little opportunity to hear about my grandfather, Eli Manuel Ben David. May his neshama have an aliyah.
Amen.